May be seated. Our third case this morning, actually three cases consolidated, 2021-1193, 2021-1198, 2021-1210. The League of Women Voters of Ohio et al. Versus the Ohio Redistricting Commission et al., Bria Bennett et al. Versus the Ohio Redistricting Commission et al., and the Ohio Organizing Collaborative et al. Versus the Ohio Redistricting Commission et al. For the relator, Ms. Levinson.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. I will use the first 10 minutes to explain all three relators' claim under Article 11, Section 6. Mr. Sutherland will then use 10 minutes to present the OOC's claim under Section 3. Relators reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal by Mr. Stafford. The last time that voters challenged an apportionment plan in this court in 2011, Wilson versus Kasich, the court found that Ohio lacked constitutional language like that of Florida and other states prohibiting political gerrymandering. The court, in its opinion, paragraph 14, specified the kind of language it would need. No apportionment plan shall be drawn with the intent of favoring or disfavoring a political party. Ohio voters listened and in 2015 voted overwhelmingly in a bipartisan basis to supply this and more language to end the scourge of gerrymandering in our state starting in 2021. But the Redistricting Commission refused to comply and enacted the egregiously partisan plan that's now before this court. The issue here, whether Article 11, Section 6 in particular, is actionable. The only way the enacted plan can stand is if the respondents convince you that Section 6 consists of empty words that they were free to ignore. But this provision is real, and this court has the authority to enforce it. I'll address these things. First, Section 6 is mandatory and enforceable. And second, that the commission violated Section 6B, the proportionality requirement, and 6A, the plan must not favor requirement. The text of Section 6 confirms that its standards are mandatory. We should look at the first and last sections to see that. The central section are the standards that it sets forth. Pointing first to the last sentence, nothing in this section permits the commission to violate the district standards described in Section 2, 3, 4, 5, or 7 of this article. Providing these exemptions to Section 6 would make no sense if Section 6 were not mandatory. If not mandatory, it would be unnecessary to list the occasions when Section 6 must be set aside. It would otherwise fall aside by itself in deference to any other mandatory provisions. And the other provisions are mandatory. More clearly, that's not being challenged here. Instead, because it's mandatory, Section 6 needs to contain this instruction telling when to set it aside to show its place in the hierarchy of standards. Section 6.
Let's talk about standards. Nothing in the new Article 11 has the word burden of proof or standard of proof, does it?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so as of Wilson v. Kasich, the standard would be beyond a reasonable doubt?
That was the standard in that case that the court determined applied, yes, Your Honor. But,
and so there's no change because there's no language in the article, correct?
I would like to address that. First of all, whatever burden of proof there is, we've met it. But we believe that the ordinary civil preponderance of evidence applies here. What changed is this. Wilson versus Kasich involved old Article 11. It didn't have language either stating the burden of proof. It did have a section that was construed here. There were district drawing provisions that were co-equal and irreconcilable. The commission could not honor one without violating another. And the court agreed that to correct the violation of one section would cause a violation of another. What's different in new Article 11, we don't have that situation. The hierarchy of standards is clear. There's no need to violate, no cause, no permission to violate any of the standards in Article 11 as it exists today.
Wouldn't we have to overrule a half a dozen cases to change it to preponderance?
I don't think so. I think you would look at Wilson and distinguish it. You would say that was construing previous Article 11, and today Article 11 is different. The set of circumstances that we're facing here is also different. Here, the commission isn't choosing between a rock and a hard place and doesn't have any discretion to decide, like, well, should we go this way, should we go that way? Discretion was afforded the commission then. Now, we have a commission saying, we don't think we have to comply with this provision of the Constitution. So interpreting the Constitution is, the Ohio Constitution is a job for this court, not for the commission.
Okay, Ms. Levinson, to your right. I'm to your right.
Thank you. It's so hard to tell with masks and, yeah, sorry.
When we look at that burden of proof, some of the rationale for why it has been beyond a reasonable doubt before is that it's looked at as sort of legislative action. Now, with the new process in Article 11, when we look at what the Redistricting Commission did, was required to do and did, whether it be on its face in the statute or as applied as it really occurred with the evidence here, would you consider this to be legislative action, and is that a basis for looking at a different standard of review?
I would think that the commission, here the intent of the voters in enacting these standards that the commission must follow, the job of the commission was to follow these standards. And so they were bound to apply these rules.
But I mean, when we look at legislative action requiring an official constitutional challenge, requiring the highest standard of proof, I mean, aren't there safeguards that go into that process with due deliberation, so many days of deliberation? And looking at the process of how this took place here, does this have the same safeguards that legislative action would for us to sort of presume its constitutionality?
I would say that what happened here does not deserve that presumption, does not merit that presumption, because the process was not followed. The commission was to act in open. The information was not shared among the commissioners, and the public was not involved in the process to the extent that the new Article 11 required. So if the process did not unfold the way the article required that it should not be given
the presumption. So would there be presumption, starting with what I hear you say, though, you don't want to even, if there is a presumption, it was not, the process would negate the reliance on that presumption. In other words, what happened here with the drawing by the legislature and the activities of the, or lack of activities of the commission would actually, you're saying, are sufficient to rebut that presumption.
Thank you, Your Honor, for putting it that way. Chief Justice, I like what you said, and I think that's
well,
true.
Is that what you believe?
I do believe you said it more artfully than I had. Because first of all, even if there were a presumption, the facts rebut it. And I don't know that that a presumption of constitutionality should necessarily. Perhaps this is the first time that the Article 11 has been construed. And the question is it required to obey its precepts or not? This is the highest order of question that should go to a court, not to a commission to decide. To go back to where it was talking about that it is mandatory according to the way that it is written and the voters intended it. I'd like to point to the the beginning of the provision, because it bookends. I discussed the last created exceptions that would not need to be there if it were not mandatory, and the first explains why those exceptions need to be there as well. Section 6 begins, "The Commission shall attempt to draw a General Assembly District plan that meets all of the following standards." Excuse me. The word "shall" is mandatory, and the word "attempt" doesn't diminish its mandatory force here. Those words are necessary to show how the Section 6 standards fit into the hierarchy of all of the Article 11 standards. The word "attempt" here acknowledges that one can, indeed one must, deviate from the Section 6 standards if required in order to meet the other standards, as the last sentence says. So respondents here, in fact, could have and should have deviated from the Section 6 standards if and only if those other listed standards required them to do so. But they have never asserted that there was a need to obey any other section of Article 11 that forced them to make their plan favor their party.
Let me take you back to the remedy thing, which I think where you started. Section D1 provides provides remedies in the cases of violations of sections 2, 3, 4, 5, 7. Your claim is under Section 6. There's no explicit reference to Section 6 in here as far as remedies. Does that mean that this court has more authority to do things, more flexibility for a violation of Section 6 than in any of the enumerated sections?
The scheme of Article 11 actually shows that Section 9B is the remedy that's provided for when a plan, a legislative plan, is found invalid by this court.
But you do have a specific remedy provision here that talks about 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7.
Yes,
right?
Yes,
right.
Your Honor.
So if there's a violation of those sections, then the court's power is limited, but if there's a violation of Section 6, then we have much broader power. Is that your position?
No, they're limited in both circumstances. Under Section 9D, the provisions, the limited ones that you're referring to, the special ones for violations of those sections, the court can either order the enactment of a whole new plan under some circumstances, or it can order that the commission redo districts, 1 to 3 House districts, or up to 2 Senate districts. But under 9B, that's a different remedy for different situations. It's the global remedy for violations not covered by 2, 3, 4, 5, or 7, which would include 6.
So the court has more authority when it comes to a violation of the provision that says the commission shall try than it does the provisions that say explicitly what the commission must do? Is that how we should read this?
Well, the commission shall try. It needs to make an attempt. In this case, they didn't make an attempt. And I'd like to discuss what try means. It's not really more authority under 9B. It's different authority.
Well,
this is the global authority.
Our authority is pretty limited under D3, right?
In either case, you can order the commission to enact a new map. It's just that that's
only
the...
for some violations.
Some violations right.
So
under...
2, 3, 4, 5, and 7.
Under 9D, you can order the commission to enact some new districts or an entire map, depending on how isolated or pervasive the violations are. And under 9B, you can do one of those remedies, too. It's just a whole map. You just have one choice under 9B. And 9B is the remedy that is provided here for a legislative plan that violates Article 11. It's the same words to the remedy provided in Article 19 if a congressional plan is invalid. I see my light has come on, and I don't want to infringe on my co-respondent's time.
Okay.
Shall I answer the question, or shall I allow
answer
them to?
Answer the question.
Okay. So the fact that this is the scheme in the Constitution, in the Ohio Constitution, for remedying an unconstitutional plan.
So why did, if we have 9B, why are those other provisions necessary at all then?
Okay, those other provisions, these are more tailored remedies because it can be the whole plan or a partial plan that is ordered. These are remedies that are specified for plans that violate just these certain sections, and these sections have to do with limiting political subdivision splits, assigning representatives and senators to districts. Many violations of these sections don't necessarily infect the whole map, and they may well be able to be fixed in a targeted way. So they receive, under 9D, appropriately targeted remedies as provided, scalpel or sledgehammer, like which do you have to do to fix these? But a Section 6 violation is aimed at a systemic problem, that infects a whole map. So the remedy for Section 6 doesn't belong under 9D, under the scheme. It's put under Section 9B, which is the global remedy that provides for a new plan. If we read Section 6D as the sole set of remedies available to the court under Article 11, then there's no place for 9B at all. What's 9B even doing in the Constitution? Clearly, 9B is meant to be the global remedy for things that don't follow under 2, 3, 4, 5, or 7.
Beyond the argument that we, I'm sure, will hear, is that 9B is, excuse me, that Section 6 is aspirational. That's, so it's not with the same force and effect as the other provisions in this constitutional amendment, that it's kind of an overarching, yet from what I'm hearing, no remedy to address. I'm not sure what it's even there for then, but that's what I'm going to hear. So let's hear what you have to say on that.
Sure. I mean, the fact people call it aspirational, I guess, because the word attempt appears in there. But the word attempt can be very clearly understood to mean that the standards of Section 6 are only to be applied to the extent that they don't, because it says shall meet, you shall meet these unless, you should attempt to meet them. You need an excuse for not meeting them. And that's why you need an attempt. So your excuse can be if what you do under Section 6, under 6A, B, or C, would cause you to violate any of these other provisions, these technical specific splitting provisions. It says you can't do that, but to the extent that that you can, you must comply with Section 6. Just that determines the edge of your compliance.
Counsel, let's go back to the word scheme that you used. In your complaint, paragraph 44, in the Bennett complaint, paragraph 42, and in the OOC complaint, paragraph 54, all point us to Section 8, the impasse procedure, correct?
Yes, sir.
And so that's the one we're under. And in effect, we're under 8C1A, which is the four-year plan?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And yes, Your Honor, if what you're alluding to is there's reference to some of the language from Section 6 in the remedy when there's an impasse procedure, that's true, but it doesn't include all of Section 6. It would leave completely unaddressed prong A or prong C. But yes, we're in that impasse procedure. And frankly, that's another time when it seems obvious that Section 6 is meant to be enforceable, because in an impasse, the commission is required to issue a statement under 8C2 explaining
why. Was there a statement issued?
Yes, there was. It was, I don't know, I don't want to infringe on my co.
Right.
Should I continue?
Okay. You can sit down.
Okay. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sutherland?
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, I'm Brian Sutherland for the Ohio Organizing Collaborative and our group of relators. And I'm here to present our Section 3 claims, and because of the importance and complexity of this case, I would like to have 10 minutes for those claims, if I may. Our claims under Section 3B require compliance with the Ohio Constitution, including its Bill of Rights, as a districting standard. And violations of that districting standard require a remedy under Section 9D3B and 9D3C. And I'll go right to the rule that I would like this court to adopt in connection with our Section 3 claims. The court should hold that a plan violates Article 1, Section 2, when the plan causes a person's vote to have significantly diminished value without justification, so that the person does not have an equal opportunity to alter or reform their government by electing representatives to the General Assembly. In determining whether a plan has significantly diminished the value of a person's vote, the court should look at political party representation in the General Assembly and assess whether differences in representation caused by the districting plan are those that make a material difference in the ability of a political party to influence and enact legislation. And of course, I'm talking here about the difference between supermajority representation, simple majority representation, and only minority representation in the legislature. And that's the difference in voting power that voters for the Democratic Party versus voters for the Republican Party have under this plan. We've shown that with the same share of the vote, the Republican Party, with 54% of the statewide vote, would have a supermajority in the legislature as compared with only minority representation for the Democratic Party. So that's a vast disparity in voting power. It's like if you're playing a game of basketball, one side has a 10-foot hoop and the other side has a 15-foot hoop.
Counsel, the formula in the Constitution is that you take, or at least the formula, is that you take the 10 years and you identify the votes that are cast on a statewide ballot for statewide office holders, and that summation for both calculation turns out to be 54-46.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. If that's applied, if that's the guidepost on how to figure the rest of the apportionment, is that what you're arguing for, or you say even that's not fair?
That's the Section 6 proportionality claim.
Right.
That the proportion of districts should closely correspond to the statewide preferences of the voters. And we have that claim also. I'm here advocating a Section 3 equal protection claim, which says don't treat voters unequally under the Section 3 line drawing rules. And that takes you to a slightly different place than the Section 6 claim, and I can illustrate that with numbers. Under Dr. Amai's alternative maps, the average number of Republican-leaning districts was about 59. That's after following the Section 3 line drawing rules and avoiding cracking and packing voters into districts. But the enacted plan would award the Republican Party about 63 districts, which is a significant disparity as between simple majority representation and supermajority representation. Now, Dr. Roden's map, this is the one where he attempted to comply with Section 6B, takes you to 56 Republican-leaning seats in the House. So that's the difference between 59 under equal protection and 56 under Section 6 proportionality. That's the evidence in this case. In terms of the standard of review, several reasons why you wouldn't have a presumption of constitutionality here. One is the infringement of fundamental rights. And when you're in that context, which was not the context in Wilson, there was no equal protection claim in Wilson. When we're talking about the infringement of fundamental rights under the Ohio Constitution, those that are explicitly incorporated into Article 11 by Section 3B2, the standard ought to be Ohio's form of an Anderson-Burdick balancing test, like the one discussed in State X. Rel. Brown versus Ashtabula County. Under a balancing test, the court can look at the unequal treatment of voters on the one hand, and we've shown that because of the disparity in voting power, And then, second, look at whether that disparity is justified. If it's not justified, then the plan is unconstitutional, and this court should order the commission to enact a new one. Respondents are about to argue that the line-drawing rules themselves and the political geography justify the disparity in voting power. That's not correct. You can draw alternative maps. Dr. Amai has demonstrated that. With 59 Republican-leaning seats under his alternative maps, those are ones that don't pack and crack voters into districts. And the harm from packing is evident. It should have been apparent when drawing this map that if you take the supporters of a political group and put them into a district, they won't have the equal opportunity to obtain representation at the General Assembly level. They're also going to say, well, there's regionalized disproportionality in the counties. The plan does gerrymander the counties, but the relevant basis for assessment is at the statewide level because the General Assembly and not 11 representatives from Franklin County are the ones who make the laws for this state. And it's that disparity, that's the one that's important. They're also going to tell you that these types of claims are not justiciable. That's not true. The states of Pennsylvania and North Carolina have adjudicated these types of claims under their state's constitution. This court can do the same. The Supreme Court's decision in Rucho should be viewed as a federalism decision, a decision that leaves these types of decisions to the states. Here we are in the states, and we've created an administrable standard for this court to apply. It is a case-by-case standard, but it's one that the court can adjudicate based on the evidence in front of you, the disparity in voting power, and a total lack of justification for that disparity, as demonstrated by the comments on the record immediately after the hearing before the commission.
Counsel, in your analysis, is there at any point a justification for the creation of a supermajority in a legislature? Not just Ohio, in the legislature.
Could in any other state, could there ever be a supermajority in the legislature or the general?
Theoretically, is a supermajority, to your way of thinking, imposes an unconstitutional limitation on the representation of the voters?
Well, it would depend entirely on the statewide vote.
Okay, so you there is the formula that you're not abandoning the numbers here in Ohio, the 54-46 numbers.
No, we're not saying that the section, for the purposes of the equal protection claim in particular, and for the Section 6 claim too, the point is not that the Section 8C2 statement is wrong and that the 54-46 ratio is incorrect. Under that set of numbers, yes, the supermajority is unconstitutional. If it were a different set of numbers, then
exactly.
The supermajority would potentially be
could
constitutional.
Be. Could be.
Certainly,
so
if
you're
there
not
were
saying that supermajorities in and of themselves is a concept that is unconstitutional.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm talking about the difference between the enacted plan and the plan that should have been enacted if voters were not cracked and packed into districts and the ways that you determine whether inequality in voting power, which essentially ought to be uncontested on this record, is justified. The Section 8C2 statement to which Your Honor is referring is a good indication, by the way, that voters in Ohio strongly believed that political parties are a cohesive group. What you'll see from opinions like Rucho and respondents are about to argue, political parties, they'll say, they're not cohesive. People change their vote from year to year, or they change their party affiliation. In the aggregate, political party affiliation is stable, but perhaps more importantly, the voters in 2015 sent a strong message that they believe, and they directed this court to conclude, that political party affiliation is a cohesive group. If they didn't conclude that, they couldn't have directed the commission to calculate the 54-46 number that we're talking about. And you see that also reflected in Senate President Huffman's brief. It is a litany. It's a discussion of the settlement conference in which the parties discussed how many Republican-leaning districts should we have, how many Democratic-leaning districts should we have. The shared premise of that entire debate was that they knew to a certainty what the Republican-leaning districts would be. So for the respondents, they cannot now tell you in the face of Section 8C2 that political party affiliation is not a basis on which to pack people into groups. That's exactly what they did. And it doesn't take a political scientist to know that if you take people associated with a group and you pack them into a district, they will miss out on opportunities to have equal representation in the General Assembly with profound consequences for the laws of this state. The difference between majority and supermajority is certainly a significant one.
You're also trying to make, over here, a First Amendment freedom of speech, freedom of assembly type argument, correct?
Those are injuries that likewise flow from the disparity in voting
power,
Your
claim. What the fact a line divides a county or concludes a county, how does that stop people from getting together and petitioning the government?
It doesn't stop petitioning. It discourages organizing. And it discourages.
But it doesn't stop them from getting together.
It doesn't stop them from getting together. That's right,
Thank
Your
you.
Honor. It's the injury described in the affidavits of our clients, the ones that talk about people being discouraged because they don't think the government is instituted for their equal protection and benefit. That's an associational injury. They can't organize and advocate and effectuate change the way they should. It's a right to alter and reform the government for the equal benefit and protection of people. That doesn't happen when people have totally unequal voting power.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Levinson? No, I'm sorry.
Strack?
Yes, Mr. Strack. You'll have, I believe, 25 minutes. Is that what you've agreed to?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. This case is about a General Assembly district plan that was the most constitutionally compliant of all the plans that the commission considered. No plan that was filed by Democratic members of the commission fully complied with the Constitution. Those other plans violated the anti-gerrymandering rules set forth in sections 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7 of Article 11 of the Constitution. These anti-gerrymandering rules are neutral rules limiting political discretion of map drawers by limiting how and when they can split counties and other political subdivisions. Testimony shows, in fact, that these rules alone prevented the ability to draw several Republican-leaning districts in Northeast Ohio. So this case is all about Section 6. The relators have brought their claims under Section 6. We believe that Section 6 is most properly understood in what I will refer to as a carrot and stick framework of Article 11 that the voters of the state created. The stick, in part, is Section 6 through the remedy section of Section 9. You have to construe Section 6 and Section 9 together. But the stick is very limited. First, it doesn't apply if there's a 10-year map. And we believe that the voters did that so that it would promote a political compromise. It incentivizes both sides to come together if they want a 10-year map, to come together, and they don't have to worry about Section 6 at all. If they can cut a deal, they can cut a deal. They've got a 10-year map. That's one of the carrots.
So what's the incentive for the minority party under that?
To get as good a deal as they can get because it's a 10-year map. And they don't have to worry about the uncertainty of the four-year map because the four-year map is a problem for both parties.
How do you go about doing that, get as good a deal as they're able to get if they're the minority party in the commission?
Through negotiation and compromise, which is exactly what happened here. The parties, the commission members here, the legislative commission members even exchanged actual maps. They literally negotiated over how many Republicans are leaning districts, you know, how many Democratic leaning
districts.
Don't
they have to start, though, if you're negotiating on some level playing field with the understanding of what's affecting the decision? And my concern or question is, you have the voting tallies, and for the statewide office holders, it comes up to 5446. Is that, you understand?
That's if you look at votes cast.
Well, that's what we're supposed to do.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
The Constitution uses the term election results.
Okay.
That could mean votes cast.
That, right, but That's one way of looking at it, I guess, and the other way is just one for one. You got all these, you know, elected office holders, they all go in the Republican column, and these elected office holders go in the Democratic, and there's like 81-19, is that the percentage?
That's the current percentage.
Okay, so then you take those numbers, somehow mix them together, and come up with what?
Well, Your Honor, there's nothing in Section 6 that says the commission has to make some sort of final determination, because what's important here and what I want to make sure the court understands before I step away from the podium today, Section 6 does not apply if the commission complies in a four-year map with the anti-gerrymandering rules, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7. It simply doesn't apply. Section 9 clearly provides that this court's authority is limited to anything regarding Section 6 unless those anti-gerrymandering requirements are violated. Well, this case then is very limited. There's been no allegation, certainly no proof, that any of those anti-gerrymandering requirements were violated, none. It's solely focused on Section 6. So this court doesn't have to interpret Section 6 in this case because on the allegations alone, because there's no violation of the anti-gerrymandering requirements, then Section 6 is simply not applicable. And that makes sense within the carrot and stick framework of Article 11. The Constitution says, look, if you're going to have a four-year map, you couldn't cut a deal, you couldn't have come to a compromise. Section 6 is there waiting to hit you over the head unless you follow the neutral rules in 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7. And if you follow those neutral rules, then we're going to assume that that limited your political discretion. But otherwise, Section 6 is not going to apply. And so I think it's important for this court to consider the fact that when you look at Section 9, the people of the state not only changed the rules for the commission, and in fact created the commission, and set forth this detailed rules of construction for how you draw the districts, they also changed this court's authority. And in some respects, they limited this court's authority. They said, for instance, unlike before, this court can't order a particular district. It can't order a particular plan. All it can do is enforce the anti-gerrymandering requirements, and if there's a violation there, then the court has the authority to look at Section 6. So this is unlike Wilson v. Kasich in one sense, in that case there was a question about whether the neutral rules were even violated.
Why isn't Section 6 an anti-gerrymandering requirement?
Because it's not mandatory. And what it is, Your Honor, Justice Bruner, it is a potential stick over the majority if they don't follow the actual anti-gerrymandering rules. That's what that is. And so you have to scrupulously adhere to those. And what's stark about this case is of all the plans before the commission that is actually considered, the adopted plan was the only one that did it. And the record is replete with evidence that the other plans were either had non-contiguous portions or split counties or political subdivisions that they weren't supposed to under the detailed rules. And there has literally been no allegation from the beginning of this case that the adopted plan did any of that. And so under the carrot and stick framework of Article 11, it worked. It worked. And how do I know it worked? Well, because the evidence shows that, let's just take the House map, the House plan. It started off with, as introduced, with 67 Republican-leaning districts in the House.
Which is more than the number of elected Republicans now at 65, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But that's what the political geography under this new census data, that's how that shook out. However, what happened was a series of meetings, exchanging of maps, and that was the compromise because everyone wanted a 10-year map. So that's the carrot. And so everyone was trying to work towards a 10-year map. The Democratic plan moved from 55 to 57 Republican-leaning districts. The House plan went down from 67 to 62 Republican-leaning districts. And then all of this, there was a flurry of meetings and activity right before the deadline to see if we can sort of meet in the middle. And it didn't happen. But what happened was you had a less partisan-leaning map that ultimately was adopted. The commission could have said, you know what, we can't cut a deal. We've complied with the anti-gerrymandering requirements. We're going to go back and we're going to adopt that 67 Republican-leaning House plan. We're going to do that because we can. They didn't do that. They decided to stick with to the extent the compromise had gotten them somewhere, they decided to go with a less partisan-leaning plan. And in my opinion, that is because of the carrot and stick framework of Article 11 and the constitutional process reforms that the people enacted in this state worked.
Council, do you think there was any role for the commission members in the drafting of the plan beyond just up or down vote?
I believe the commission's duty was to adopt a plan. That's an up or down vote. Now, various commission members were involved in different ways. The Democratic commission members hired their own map drawer. If the court remembers, one of the vestiges of the old apportionment board is that there's a pot of money
right. That
the Democrat caucus gets and the Republican caucus
gets.
So they actually had money to go hire people, and they did. And that's where most of the negotiations took place. The statewide elected officials had some involvement in conversations.
According to the Secretary of State, his role was extremely limited and to the point of being excluded.
Well, I know the evidence shows that he was involved in a lot of meetings. He had a lot of conversations. And at the end of the day, Secretary of State LaRose voted for the plan, and he testified that he believes it's constitutional.
That's true, counsel, but doesn't the record demonstrate that Secretary LaRose was extremely frustrated and he only did that just to go along with that partisan vote, but that he was extremely frustrated throughout the entire process, as was Governor DeWine, about not being included in the actual process or being allowed to have representatives there as well during the map-making process?
But Justice Donnelly, I think it's a fair characterization of how he described himself that he was frustrated. I think that's certainly fair to say. However, I also know that no request that he made to Speaker Cupp or to President Huffman was denied, not any direct request. And I know that the evidence shows that he was very involved in the final week or so in the negotiations when everybody was talking to everybody. And it was a flurry of activity. And I want the court to understand that's how this process works. And to the extent that they wanted to influence it, they certainly had the opportunity. But at the end of the day.
He voted for it, obviously. His characterization based on the emails that are in evidence is the plan is asinine.
Correct. That's his words.
Okay. And then you have the governor saying something about in his heart or he believed that they could have negotiated a more constitutional plan. So a more constitutional isn't something either constitutional or it's not.
Correct.
I mean, do you nibble around the edges of a provision and say, well, it's kind of constitutional.
I believe, Your Honor, I totally agree with your point of view on that. But I would also say that Governor DeWine also testified in a deposition that he believes the plan was constitutional.
Oh, now, after voting for it, and obviously along party lines here.
That's correct. The legally relevant action here is the vote. The vote was the vote. That's what adopted the plan. What people said about it, we believe, is legally irrelevant. The newspapers like that, but we don't believe it has any role in the court's decision in this particular matter.
Excuse me, are you advocating that the 81% of, for the definition of election results, are you advocating that it should be 81% to 19% as opposed to 54% to 46%?
Your Honor, the 81% as part of the Section 8C2 statement, that's simply an analysis. So the commission said, we don't really know what election results means in this section of the Constitution. One way of looking at it is this 81-19 figure. Another way of looking at it is votes cast, that's 54-46. So we're going to look at both of them. We see our plan is in the middle. In fact, it's closer to the 54-46 than to the 81. We think in our discretion that that closely corresponds.
But the 81-19, if you're, because then you get, you know, all the office holders in for every office for Republican, that was a Republican victory, you put them in the Republican column, and there's no equivalent number or representation of all of the other party, Democrat or Democratic leading independents that voted. There's no accounting for their vote when you go to the 81-19 in each one of those offices. You're not accounting for the vote that was cast for the other candidate.
That's absolutely correct. That's why they looked at it both ways. And unfortunately, Section 8 is not very clear on how to do this analysis. Certainly, the voters could have put very specific language. There's formulas you can use. They could have put a math equation in there and said, hey, here's how you do it. They didn't do that. They left vague language that the commission had to interpret, and the commission, frankly, did the best job they could under the circumstances that they had. Drawing districts, adopting plans like this, it's hard work. It is hard work. You're talking about 132 districts that have to be based on geography. And we've pointed out that in this state, in the House plan, 81 counties, and in the Senate plan, 83 counties are politically the same, that you can't draw different districts in those. You're literally looking at just a handful of counties in each plan. And so remarkably, between the Democratic proposal and the Republican proposal, there were only five districts that differed in terms of the political leaning in the House, and only three in the Senate. So you're talking about a total of 8 out of 132 districts where the parties differed as to what should happen, how, where the line should go. That's a remarkable outcome in a state like Ohio with that many districts and the kind of political pressure that each member, you gotta remember, each of these commission members is an elected official in his or her own right. And they have constituencies that they otherwise have to go to. And so I believe that Article 11 and the framework that it set up worked. It created opportunities for compromise. It incentivized compromise. It had a hook, a stick out there that could be used if you didn't follow the anti-gerrymandering rules. And at the end of the day, the people got a less partisan plan. It may not be the plan that the relators want. It may not be the plan that the relators' computer algorithms might spit out. But it is a plan based on the people of Ohio and their elected representatives trying to come together and trying to work it out.
So in the computer program that Ray DeRossi, who was working for, I believe, the House or the Senate was using, there was a little box in the window. So every time he changed the lines of the precincts, it gave him that proportionality of what the registration Democrat, Republican would be of those voters. If that's the case, why do we have to ignore it?
Well, he didn't ignore it. So actually, in this case, what the evidence reflects, Justice Bruner, is that both the Democrats and the Republicans created an index using election data that they had publicly available from 2016, 18, and 20. And they used the same races, and they actually did that so they could make apples-to-apples comparisons among the maps. So, they looked at it because a compromise wasn't going to be reached as a practical matter unless each side had a similar understanding of what the political lean was of this district versus that district. So he did look at that. The Democrats looked at that equally.
But I think he said he was instructed to and that he did ignore it.
No, he was not instructed to try to comply with Section 6. He was instructed to make sure that the anti-gerrymandering rules were followed and that the commission, if any role was to play with Section 6, that would be the commission, not him. I think that's probably where that testimony is coming from. I do not recall him saying he didn't look at the political data. He had to. Everybody did, because that's how the negotiations occurred. Each district was scored in terms of its partisan lean, using the data that the Constitution contemplates, And then the Democrats and the Republicans would then compare maps and haggle over it. And that's just how it happened.
But I thought the testimony was that Section 6 was not even in the equation, was not even being considered by the map drawers, and the same thing with their bosses, the folks that gave them the instruction on what to do and how to do it here.
The map drawers were told you need to comply with 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7 for sure.
Okay.
Because if you don't comply with those, Section 6 might come into play. So that was their job.
Well, why isn't Section 6 in play?
Because Section 9 clearly states that unless there's a violation of 2, 3, 4, 5, or 7, this court has no authority to do anything about Section 6. And so the instruction to the map drawers, be sure, scrupulously adhere to those rules. We don't want something like Wilson v. Kasich, where there's arguing over whether we violated the neutral rule. We don't want that. Comply with those rules to the letter, and if Section 6 is to come into play at all, the commission members, who are the politicians, they'll deal with that.
But that's only for a four-year map.
That's correct.
So were they anticipating a four-year map because they didn't want to do a 10-year map?
That's why this process is so hard, Justice Bruner. They had to interpret, they had to expect everything. They all wanted a 10-year map. That's very clear. But it's tough. You're trying to get a deal on a 10-year map, but you know out in the back of your mind we might not have a deal, so we got to be thinking about a four-year map.
So he was looking at the numbers in the window then, right?
Yes, he and the Democrats were. Everybody was. They had to. That's the only way you could negotiate. That's the only way you could come up with a compromise. And so everybody was doing that. And the point I'm making here today is that because the anti-gerrymandering rules were followed, Ohio has a less partisan map than they might otherwise have had because of the efforts at compromise and negotiations over those partisan leans of the districts. And I do want to point out that if there is a violation of the anti-gerrymandering requirements, Section 6 is not a dead letter. We're not arguing that Section 6 is like the appendix in the body and it's just of no use and it's just out there hanging. It's of use because if you violate those requirements, then this court then, depending on the extent of the violations of those requirements, then has the authority to potentially order a redraw based on that alone. And that would be a significant situation to be in. And I believe the good thing here in this case in 2021 is that because there are no such violations, this court doesn't have to grapple with the very hard situation of, okay, are we gonna mandate proportional representation? And we got to think through, if we're going to do that, if 81 and 83 counties are basically politically the same, we're going to order that we're going to fight gerrymandering by gerrymandering in the urban counties. Is that really what we want to do?
But do we ignore the word shall? Do we ignore that at least under 6A that they shall attempt? Because this is essentially, we can tell from the language that 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7 are paramount. And when we've accomplished those, we're also supposed to look for whatever attempt was required to be made to deal with sort of the icing on the cake, which is the proportionality. And it's clear from the evidence that that didn't happen.
Justice Bruner, we would respectfully disagree with that interpretation of Article 11. We don't believe that you can interpret Section 6 outside of also Section 9, which talks about what the authority that this court has. Now, in terms of an attempt, but even irrespective of that, you know, attempt means basically to try. It says shall attempt, but attempt clearly modifies shall. And in the other sections, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7, it just says shall. So those are clearly mandatory. And we can't say that shall attempt means shall, otherwise it would read the word attempt out. So that can't be the case. So attempt means to try. And we believe that in this particular case, the process of negotiating and compromising, coming down from 67 to 62, trying to find that common ground, that middle ground, that certainly that is an attempt to move yourself towards the other side's position. And that's what we think the carrot and stick approach of Article 11 is designed to do. It's to try to incentivize each side to move towards each other. And that clearly happened here. It's undisputable evidentiary wise that is what happened here. And so we think that is how Article 11 was designed to work. Article 11 was really process-oriented reforms, and even the ballot language suggests that it was basically designed to set up a process that would make it harder to so-called gerrymander, right? And it did that. It did that. It resulted in a less partisan map that the people of the state can be proud of.
All right, counsel, let's say we disagree with you and this court orders the commission to start over. Okay, then what happens? They come up with a new map?
It depends on what the basis of the court's ruling. If the court says, well, we say Section 6 is mandatory regardless of Section 9, if the court says Section 9 doesn't matter, we're going to look at Section 6 on its own, this court then has to provide some guidance to the commission.
Okay, and what type of guidance would you think that would be?
The Section 6 does not define what it means by the statewide preferences. That can be calculated 100 different ways.
So the court then would determine what that means?
They would have to determine what that means. They would have to determine what closely corresponds means.
Okay, and then say the court put that all in an opinion, issued those directives, then what happens?
Well, one of two things happens. Either the commission tries to comply, if it can, or the commission or certain parties decide to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and say, nope, this Ohio Supreme Court has now ordered us to violate federal law by gerrymandering in the urban counties because we can't gerrymander in the rural counties. So I think the court in this case, because the anti-gerrymandering rules were scrupulously complied with, the court doesn't have to go anywhere near those questions this decennial census, and those are questions for another day. And, Your Honor, it looks like my time, it looks like I'm past my 25 minutes.
One question and follow-up,
yeah,
Chief.
You can.
Then how does Russo affect that if you go to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Comcast v. Russo says that you can't go to federal court for a claim of partisan gerrymandering under the Equal Protection Clause. That doesn't mean, though, that a state Supreme Court might not violate the Equal Protection Clause in a way that's reminiscent of a case called Larios versus Cox, where the parties there, through tactics such as double bunking and manipulating population numbers, hurt one party over the other. That might still be a claim if a state Supreme Court ordered a commission to do what the relators are asking the court to do.
Okay, but let's just say we get to the point where the commission has drawn a new map, all right?
Yes.
Then what happens with that map? Is it subject to litigation? Is it?
In my world, every redistricting plan is subject to litigation. Generally, is challenged. I assume it could be, but I don't. I'm not following you, Chief.
Well, I mean, we're here because of the map that the General Assembly drew, and which was approved by the Commission, adopted by the Commission, right?
It was drawn by the Commission and adopted by the Commission.
Well, the General Assembly's version, let's put it that way, was accepted.
I wouldn't say that's necessarily fair. It was a negotiated effort by many of the commission members. It was certainly the MAPTITUDE program was certainly operated by staffers for the General Assembly on both the House and the Democratic side.
Okay, so that's put to the commission. We reject it for some reason. We send it back with complete instructions on where we find the issues and what we believe is the remedy. Then it goes back to the commission for them to create a new map, right?
Right.
Okay, and Obviously, if that's unchallenged, that becomes the redistricting. Okay. Correct. If it is challenged and it's back here, this could go on forever.
Ad nauseum.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Yes. I just wanted to make sure that that was the, but we're also under time constraints.
Correct.
All right. So tell me how that impacts here.
Well, at some point, if the state of Ohio doesn't have valid legal redistricting plans, someone could go to federal court and say the state of Ohio can't get their stuff together, so federal judge, you please draw the map.
You think that's...
That could happen.
Okay.
At the same time, we're all of us are coming upon a February 2nd, 2022 filing deadline. So in the 2020 election, the question of the primary during the pandemic and changing the date of the primary was, under those factual circumstances, found to be within the purview of the legislature. So what happens there? Does this court, under these circumstances, have any ability to change that filing deadline or the primary election date, or is that solely within the purview of the legislature?
We believe it's solely within the purview of the legislature, but obviously this court has its own authority, but we think that that would be in the purview of the legislature. So we think the court would be prudent to act within the existing deadlines.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Clark, I see you've got 5 minutes.
I can. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I can be brief.
No, take your five.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to focus a little bit on the language of the Constitution again and respond to a couple of assertions made by opposing counsel. Section 9B is not a grant of remedial power to this court. Section 9B is what it instructs the commission on what it is to do if the court invalidates a plan. How, when a court can invalidate a plan is found in Section 9D. Section 9D is not a subsection that is specific to violations of Sections 2, 3, 4, 5, or 7. It starts with a blanket statement. No court shall order in any circumstance the implementation or enforcement of any General Assembly district plan that has not been adopted by the Commission in the manner prescribed by this article. So subsection D is not a section dealing with a certain number of technical requirements in Article 11. It is a blanket prohibition against doing something regardless of when, regardless of what reason. Then goes on to talk about, okay, now when can the court do something? And that's when Section 9D starts to reference the sections of Article 11 on which the court can act. And it's important to note that there is a time for consideration of the Section 6B standard by this court. But that time is only when you have a four-year map and there has been significant violation of the anti-gerrymandering Sections 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7. When that happens, this court is empowered to consider the Section 6B standard. But only in that case, only when that happens. I would like just to turn as well to Section 6 itself and the assertion that shall means that there is a mandatory requirement that is only bounded by an inability to comply with Sections 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7. Section 6 could have been written much more simply if that were the proper interpretation. The entire first sentence of Section 6 could have gone away, and the people of Ohio in enacting this section could have just started with the map shall not favor a political party, the map, et cetera, et cetera, sections A, B, and C. That could have been the start. But instead, the amendment starts with shall attempt. Likewise, because, and the reason that works is because we have the limiting sentence at the end that says, okay, you don't have to comply with this if you shouldn't not comply with sections 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7 in order to comply with 6. That's clear already without the first sentence of section 6, which must mean something. And that what it means, as is in the briefs, is an attempt, a try, something that happens sometimes without success. So ultimately, the court has to ask whether it wants to wade into allegations of proportionality untethered by standards that are discernible. And section 9D makes clear that the people of Ohio decided that should not happen in this instance. Rather, since the maps complied with sections 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7, as everyone agrees, the inquiry ends there. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Taking 10 minutes?
That's correct, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Ben Stafford. I appear today on behalf of the Bennett Relators. And I want to start by emphasizing some of the key points that after the party's arguments thus far I don't think are in dispute. There's been no defense of the plan passed on the merits. It's only been about this court's power to address that plan. So what's not in dispute? The map drawers were not directed to comply with Section 6. There was, in fact, no attempt made to comply with Section 6. At most, what was attempted was a politics-as-usual deal that ultimately fell apart in the end, Republicans attempting to get as many seats as possible that Democrats would stomach and sign off on. That, at best, is what was attempted, not to comply with Section 6. They don't dispute that a majority of commissioners disagree with Mr. Strzok's interpretation of Section 8C2. The way that 8C2 statement read, a majority of commissioners are on record saying they disagree with that. The Democratic commissioners, Secretary LaRose thinks that's asinine. Governor DeWine said 81% is not a number that he thought should have been considered. They do not dispute that the commission has a great number of different ways that it can comply with these technical line drawing requirements. Dr. Amai drew 5,000 different simulations. The question is what they chose to do. They concede it was easy to draw a proportional plan that weighted Democratic and Republican votes equally. That's at page 35 of the Huffman Cup brief.
Based on what? The actual votes across the state?
Based on the statewide preferences was my understanding of their argument. 81% is awfully hard to do with Ohio's actual voting patterns. But they say one can easily draw a proportional plan if one makes proportionality a criterion, is what they say. It's just they chose not to do that. They chose to draw districts in which Republicans voters could elect Republicans, and they made a particular effort to do that in Democratic-leaning parts of the state. Now, I linger on these points because there's just not any material factual disputes here. The question isn't about what the evidence shows. So the question isn't really about what evidentiary standard the court applies. To borrow a phrase from earlier, that would not be outcome determinative in this case. The question is about consequences. Are there any consequences for the commission's decision to effectively roll the dice and outright ignore Section 6? Now, I would submit that it's obvious that Ohioans did not pass the Fair District Amendments with the intention of leaving it to the partisans who they were regulating to decide whether or not they felt like complying with Section 6. And the Ohio Bill of Rights is incorporated through Section 3B2. The respondents, by contrast, say there are no consequences So long as we comply with the technical line drawing rules, we are free to press Parson Advantage as much as we want. Now, they dress it up in loftier language, but that's what it comes down to, the claim that you can't stop us. So let's turn to the constitutional text here. Again, the position of the respondents is so long as the commission doesn't violate the technical line drawing requirements, Section 6, we can ignore it. We don't have to meet the proportionality standard or the other provisions. And the argument there is that Section 9D3 sets out the only remedies, the exclusive remedies, for any violation of Article 11. But let's take a look at the structure of Section 9. Section 9 provides this court with original jurisdiction over all claims arising under Article 11. Section B is a broad grant of authority to courts of appropriate jurisdiction to declare the plan invalid or particular districts invalid. Section 9D3 cabins that authority in particular cases where there's violations of Section 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7 to provide for specific remedies. And this makes good sense. Some of those provisions are about very specific line drawing issues. If there's one county where they don't quite get it right, tucked in the southeast corner, maybe we don't have to throw out the whole map. So Section 9D3 gives us a series of rules. Nothing in 9D3 suggests it leaves the court powerless to address violations of Section 6, or for that matter, Section 1 and Section 8. Section 1, that's not referenced in 9D3. What does Section 1 do? It provides who has to be on the commission, whether the commission can pass a 10-year plan or a 4-year plan. So under the respondent's telling, the commission could constitute itself entirely with members of one political party. It could purport to pass on a party line vote a 10-year map.
Let me ask you about, I guess I'm having a hard time understanding this section, which is Section 9. It would be C, let's see, 9D, 3C, which says essentially if in considering a plan under Section 8C, the court determines that both of the following are true, the court shall order the commission to adopt the new General Assembly district plan in accordance with this article. And then it essentially says you have to have a violation of some of the district requirements as well as a violation of the Section 6, right?
That's what that, not a violation of Section 6, violation of particular language, which is somewhat similar to Section 6, but not the same.
Okay, but I guess what I'm struggling with is if the violation of that language, which would be a violation of Section 6, is enough to require that an entire new plan be drawn, what is the point of this section, which says you have to have both things to require an entire new plan to be drawn? It could be Section 1 and Section 2, or Section little I 1 and 2 here.
What this section does is indicate that if there is the kind of one-off or two-off technical line drawing issue that would normally, under the other provisions of Section 9D, result in a limited remedy, that a broader remedy is provided in that instance.
But if you're already entitled to the broader remedy because of that violation of the proportionality requirements, doesn't it really make Part I of this superfluous?
No, Your Honor. Again, there's a different standard that's set out here in 9D3C than is set out in Section 6. And note that certainly not all of Section 6 is in here. There's nothing about 6A.
How's it different? I don't see a difference. I mean, I don't see any material difference in the 2I section than Section 6.
There's no reference to 6A, the intent or the advantage of one party or the other. There's nothing about compactness. There's language that's similar to Section 6B. I would agree with Your Honor on that. But if the question is there some redundancy or overemphasis versus is Section 6 a meaningless dead letter, then one interpretation makes much more sense, we would submit, to the court. So this provides for a particular remedy of a particular line drawing violation of one of these other sections that would otherwise be governed by a different rule. It does not suggest that there is no ability to remedy a violation of Section 6. And this makes good sense because there's not just one anti-gerrymandering standard here. The people of Ohio, in their wisdom, applied a double-barreled approach. There's a set of geographic rules. One has to comply with those rules. No one disputes that. But again, there's thousands of different ways to comply with those rules. So there's a constraint on that. There is a need to seek to draw proportional districts, to not advantage a party, to draw compact districts. One can't violate those other standards, but if one can achieve proportionality, one has to achieve proportionality. That's the plain language of Section 6. One simply can't violate the technical line drawing requirements. I would note as well that certainly with respect to the argument of the OOC relators in terms of the Ohio Bill of Rights, that's a Section 3B2 claim. So there's certainly no dispute there that if that claim is cognizable, a remedy is provided in Section 6D. And if nothing else, Section 6 is a provision of the Ohio Constitution that applies to redistricting. Section 3B2 says the commission has to apply with all pertinent provisions of the Ohio Constitution applying to redistricting. So there's no way to simply read Section 6 out of existence. Section 6 isn't limited to four-year plans. It's a standalone article, a standalone section, rather, that applies to all plans drawn by the commission.
Can you address what I think opposing counsel was broaching, which is that somehow by applying the first level of requirements that deal basically with compactness, that if those are applied in the urban areas, that somehow we're skewing and going against Section 6 requirements for proportionality? I mean, wouldn't that just be the flip side of someplace like Dark County or Williams County, where it's going to be hard to do that kind of proportionality because of just the makeup of the geography there?
Well, that's right, and I could say any number of things about that, but there's many Democrats in other parts of the state as well. The rules sometimes work out as the rules work out. The record evidence here shows that they had to go out of their way to achieve these Parson outcomes. Dr. Amai just plugged in simulations, and of those 5,000 simulations, none resulted in as heavy a partisan skew as the plan before the court. Dr. Roden described his approach that he used, just to finish the answer to that question, if I may, the approach he used. He simply avoided going out of his way to crack and pack communities of similar voters. And the plan that he came up with almost perfectly achieved proportionality. They had to work hard to achieve the outcome they did. This is not about gerrymandering in favor of Democrats. It's about not gerrymandering in favor of Republicans.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will notify of our decision. Marshal, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise.